And I think what I'd like to start with is a discussion of the ratchet effects of war and other crises, for that matter. And the book on this topic is Crisis and Leviathan by Robert Higgs, which is not online, so I didn't put it on the syllabus, but this is what it looks like, Crisis and Leviathan, available for sale through the Mises Institute, the Independent Institute, and anywhere else where you can buy books online. And the subtitle is Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government. And that's a little work. It's what Robert Higgs will always be known for once he retires. And but I did put an article of his on it that explains some of the more salient facts there. Now, the ratchet effect is not something that Robert Higgs invented. Economists have been talking about this for quite a while. But no one has really developed it as much as he had in this book and attached it to the sweep of American history from the late 19th century up through the 1970s, 1980s when the book was published. And what the ratchet effect basically says is that, there is a sort of a natural growth path of government. The government doesn't need a crisis like war to grow. It grows anyway. There are a lot of reasons why government grows, and a crisis or a war is just one of them. And for example, there is a literature in economics that looks at the government as sort of like a perfectly competitive business firm that merely responds to citizen demands for services. And this theory says that as population grows, the demand for government grows on the part of the population, and therefore that's one reason government grows. Another aspect of it is that whenever the government starts up any program that benefits a segment of the population, that segment becomes a lobbying force for the program, as does all the bureaucrats who administer the program and the politicians who win votes and campaign contributions by dishing out taxpayers' dollars to the beneficiaries of the program. And so you create a built-in lobbying force for an expansion and a forever of that government program. And that is certainly true. John C. Calhoun, famous former American vice president, secretary of war, senator from South Carolina, wrote in his favorite book, A Disquisition on Government, about in any democracy, the net tax consumers, people who benefit more from government than they pay in taxes, will inevitably overwhelm politically the net taxpayers, who are people who pay more in taxes than they get in government benefits of any kind. And that'll drive the growth of government also. And there are various other theories of things that drive the growth of government. So if you can envision just a growth path, a line that say is a 45 degree angle pointing up of government as a percentage of the entire society, that happens without any kind of war or any kind of crisis. And what the ratchet effect is the effect that during a war, government uses the war as an excuse to greatly expand its powers, its taxing, its spending, its borrowing, its crushing of civil liberties, everything it does. And then when the war is over, effect of that is that the growth path of government is put on a permanently higher plane. And then when the war is over, the government never gives back to the people all of the freedoms that it took from them during the war. Tax rates never quite go back down to what they were before the war. The size of the government, the number of government employees, the size of the military, all these things are higher permanently as a result of the war. They might not be as high as they were during the war, but they never go back down to where they were before the war started. And I really would like you all to read War is the Health of the State by Randolph Bourne, which I put on the syllabus for tonight. It really is a classic essay written in 1918, quite a long time ago. It never was finished. If you look at it, it just ends. He died before he finished the essay, and then it was published after his death. And that's basically what the ratchet effect is. And what government does is to expand its existing powers and to create new powers. So there are two different categories of the growth of government that occurs during wartime. And so politicians are sort of entrepreneurial here. They use crises in an entrepreneurial way to destroy freedom and enhance their own power and privileges and perks and incomes. And the two are mutually exclusive, as far as I'm concerned. And so as far as such a thing as political entrepreneurship exists, it's not at all like real business entrepreneurship. It's entrepreneurship of the sort that isolates politicians from the imposition of the will of the voters. That's basically what political entrepreneurship is about. And war gives them the perfect example of that. Now, and of course, in the U.S., politicians have isolated themselves from citizen or taxpayer pressure when they grab our rights and increase our taxes and increase the debt and so forth by rigging the electoral system in such a way that if you were to go online and Google congressional incumbency re-election rates, you'll find some tables that show you that in the House of Representatives for about the past 50 years, the average is between 90 and 95% of all congressional incumbents. And in the Senate, it's slightly lower, it's sort of like 85%. So for all practical purposes, it's almost impossible for a member of Congress to lose his seat in Congress voluntarily, thanks to gerrymandering and the proliferation of subcommittees that are really the source of being able to hand out taxpayer finance benefits to every special interest group who could vote for you. And challengers can rarely challenge that, compete with that. And so they feel especially free in wartime to do whatever they want with us, to conscript us into their armies, to tax us at rates of 94% like they were in World War II, and worse. And because we basically have a monopoly government in the U.S. Now, in the Randolph Bourne article, he makes a number, almost every sentence is really great in that article. It's really, really learned about the essence of war. But a few things stand out. And one paragraph, I think I'll read a short little paragraph from here on page 3 that is really summarizes the main essence of what he's saying. He says this: the history of America as a country is quite different from that of America as a state. In one case, it is the drama of the pioneering conquest of the land, of the growth of wealth and the ways in which it was used, of the enterprise of education and the carrying out of spiritual ideals, of the struggle of economic classes. That's America as a country. Then he goes on to say, but as a state, its history is that of playing a part in the world, making war, obstructing international trade, preventing itself from being split into pieces, punishing those citizens whom society agrees are offensive, and collecting money to pay for it. That's the state, and is very, very different than the country. Although a lot of people mistakenly seem to equate the two, the government, the state, and the country. And of course, in peacetime, Bourne says, in such an era, the sense of the state almost fades out of the consciousness of men. People forget about it. We go about our business, we live our lives, we do our jobs, raise families. Who cares about the state? And then another very important line here on page 1, he says, but with the shock of war, however, the state comes into its own again. The government, with no mandate from the people, without consultation of the people, conducts all the negotiations, the backing and filling, the menaces and explanations, which slowly bring it into collision with some other government and gently and irresistibly slides the country into war. So there's never any mandate from the people to go to war. The people never want war. To the people, war means taxes, conscription, death, dismemberment, propaganda, lying, imprisonment. Who wants that? The average person doesn't want that. It's always just a couple of dozen people within the government who connive and manipulate and lie countries into war for reasons which the average person is never fully aware of A lot of people are vaguely aware that there must be some sort of economic agenda behind this or that war, but we are never let in on the truth about that, such as with the Iraq War, for example. And so so government is all the negotiating, the diplomacy, as they call it, which leads to war. But then, once the war starts, Randolph Bourne says, the people somehow convince themselves that they did it. They the nation, not a civil war. That's a direct result of the god of democracy that has developed over the past 100 or 150 years in America and most other places in the world. You might remember from last week, one of the points I made is that several hundred years ago, wars were just wars in Europe, or the wars between monarchs who used mercenaries. The average citizen was left out of it for the most part. But it was with the advent of democracy and nationalism that the people came to believe that the war is our war, not just the king in a dispute with another king. And so if the people convince themselves that it's really their war, and then they allow themselves to be controlled, regimented, coerced, conscripted, and so forth. And then another element of this, and I'm going to give you specific examples in American history in a little bit, is that criticism of the state is ferociously attacked. Some of you might remember at the very beginning of the war in Iraq, that began in 2003, the neoconservatives published the cover article of National Review magazine, presented by David Frum. It was entitled Unpatriotic Conservatives. And among this group they highlighted was Lou Rockwell and people like myself and the Mises Institute and LouRockwell.com and other libertarian organizations that were against the war at the time. We just didn't believe the story about weapons of mass destruction. And now the whole world knows that we were right and the neoconservatives were wrong. But that doesn't stop them, of course. They're now agitating day in and day out for more wars in Syria and Iran and North Korea. And so criticism of the state is ferociously attacked, not only by the government, but by all the various appendages of the government in the media and in politics and elsewhere. And another interesting point that Bourne makes, and I'll highlight here, and I urge you all to read the essay if you haven't, is that he believes that people have an innate desire to behave like children, to be taken care of like children, by their parents. And war gives many of us just this excuse that we'll do whatever mommy and daddy tell us, and mommy and daddy is the state in wartime. Ration our food, ration our water, send your children off to the military to die in a war that has nothing to do with you. Okay, whatever you say, mommy and daddy. That's what Randolph Bourne is saying. And I think you have to admit, if you think about it, you do see an awful lot of this in America today, of people behaving like that. Pacifists, Randolph Bourne said, are terrorized. And keep in mind, he's writing in the middle of World War I. And what does he mean by this? Well, for example, Eugene Debs, who ran for president on the Socialist Party ticket during World War I, was sentenced to 10 years in prison for merely criticizing the war, for being anti-war. He actually served 3 years in prison. There were people who were in prison for reading the Bill of Rights in public during World War I. And so that's the sort of thing that Randolph Bourne is talking about when he said that pacifists, people who are against wars, are often terrorized. There's also the oppression of minorities, that is, minority voices, not racial minorities or anything like that. And he's talking about minority dissenters. And so he concludes that there really is no such thing as democratic control of foreign policy. Foreign policy is always done by a small handful of people, maybe a couple of dozen, lost the video, and that's how it works. Okay, because we're back, I think I lost the video for 1 second there. At least it said so on my screen. Okay, and so the people, or the sheeple, if you will, just accept the ruling class of dictates. That's the final conclusion that Randolph Bourne comes to. And you certainly do see a lot of that with the worship of everything related to the military by the masses in America today. And of course, when people are saluting the military constantly, as they do today in America, they're really saluting foreign policy. It's the military that carries out the foreign policy. And so the people are sort of duped into blindly supporting whatever the ruling class says we ought to be doing, even if we all know now that we have no business in invading Iraq, for example, as any kind of defensive measure. That was never a defensive war. It was an aggressive offensive war. But we, the people accept this, and we celebrate the soldiers and everyone who participates in it. Another aspect, and of course, these are all ingredients of how the ratchet effect works. This is how the ratchet effect ratchets. It's the use of all of these tools that Randolph Bourne mentions that allows politicians to ratchet up the powers of government in the ways that they do. And of course, the financing of wars has a lot to do with it too, with why the ratchet effect succeeds in ratcheting up the powers of government. But one of the things governments always do, and we'll talk more about this in a week or two, is they engage in what some economists call fiscal illusion. That is, government has ways of making the costs of its programs appear to be much less than they are. Financing wars are always financed by some combination of taxation, borrowing by the government, and the printing of money by the central bank and the treasury. And the printing of money creates price inflation. Eventually, it creates boom and bust cycles. In any event, the government commandeers resources, however it's going to finance them. And of course, the taxation is the most direct way of financing the war, and inflation is the most indirect. And so fiscal illusion is created when the government borrows money and forces future generations to pay for its wars. And it's even more illusional when it simply prints up money. It makes the people think it costs them nothing at all, but it ultimately does cost the people a lot when government finances wars in that way. Of course, it was World War II when the U.S. government adopted the withholding tax, which makes taxation even more invisible. If you never see the money in the first place, you don't miss it quite as much as you would as if you would have to every month, once a month, write out a check to the IRS, just like you pay your mortgage and your electric bill. It would make it much more visible, much more explicit, and people would be much more opposed to these wars if they had a bigger direct bill for it. And basically what politicians do in wartime, more than anything else, is take advantage of what public choice economists call the rational ignorance effect. And the rational ignorance effect in the school of thought known as public choice basically says that in terms of the acquisition of information in our lives, the average person spends most of his time acquiring information about how to do your job, how to raise your family, how to get your kids through school, how to get the bills paid, how to take care of your home, all your private affairs. But when it comes to public policy, we just don't have the time. We don't devote the time. And besides that, government today is so big and pervasive that no human mind could possibly, conceivably comprehend more than the tiniest fraction of 1/10,000th of 1% of what government does. And so most of us remain rationally ignorant. It's rational to not spend endless hours finding out what the Department of Agriculture is up to or what the Department of Defense is up to. But the people who are special interests, the people who benefit from war, the war profiteers, the people who have a hidden agenda of one form or another, they therefore step in and are able to dominate what it is we do know. So not only do we not spend much time educating ourselves about what government is up to in wartime, but much of what we do think we know about it is lies and propaganda spread by the government itself. Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction aimed at New York City, for example, or they're murdering premature babies in Kuwait. That was the line that was told, as I mentioned last week, the first Persian Gulf War. Or special interest groups that have an agenda and spread lies and propaganda about us. So not only are we irrationally ignorant, but what little we do know is often wrong because it's propaganda spread to us by the state and its minions. But that allowed them to prevail as long as we remain that ignorant. And so, and that is how, in Robert Higgs's world, that's how ideological change occurs. And the people become more warlike, or at least more supportive of war and acquiesce in war, even if they don't themselves particularly participate in it. Even if they are chicken hawks like Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich, they can be for war, but they would never ever participate in it themselves. And so if you look at the historical examples of the ratchet effect and how a war grows the government, of course, a lot of you know that I've written several books on Lincoln and the economics of the Civil War. And this certainly is a good example of how government ratcheted up its powers during the war and never really ratcheted them back down anywhere near to where they came. The money supply was nationalized with the National Currency Act and the Legal Tender Acts, and of course the federal government never gave that up. It also imposed a 10% tax on currencies that were issued by state chartered banks. So there were competing currencies, but they were driven out of the market by taxes. As Chief Justice John Marshall said it way back in the 1820s, power to tax is the power to destroy. And by the 1860s, the government certainly understood that. And so we had that. We had the development of the Internal Revenue bureaucracy came online during the Civil War. And of course, that never disappeared either. The military-industrial complex was developed during the Civil War. 100 years before President Dwight Eisenhower made his famous farewell speech where he warned about the military-industrial complex. And by the way, it's online. Just Google Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech. It's only about 5 minutes long. And you can hear the man who was the commanding general of the Allied forces in Europe in World War II giving a dire warning about militarism. This was in 1961. But it started in 1861. Also during the Civil War, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus and arrested between 15 and 30,000 Northern civilians for merely speaking out against him and his administration. He redefined treason. Treason under the Constitution is in Article 3, Section 3. You can look it up online, Article 3, Section 3. Treason is defined as only levying war upon the states or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. And that, of course, is exactly what Abe Lincoln did, levying war upon the states. But he redefined treason as criticism of him and his government. And this wasn't his original idea. Daniel Webster, decades before, had proposed that is what treason should be, in opposition to federal power. But that's not what the Constitution says. Read Article 3, Section 3, if you want to know what treason is defined as under the U.S. Constitution. And so after the writ of habeas corpus was suspended, tens of thousands of ordinary people were imprisoned without due process. A member of Congress named Clement Vallandigham from Dayton, Ohio was deported to Canada. Over 300 newspapers were shut down, opposition newspapers everywhere from New York City to Michigan. There was actually the mass murder of dissenters. There were draft riots in New York City. And one good book about that is entitled The New York City Draft Riots by Ivor Bernstein, if anyone is interested in this. And so and there were hundreds of draft rioters who were gunned down in the streets with 15,000 troops from the recently concluded Battle of Gettysburg who sent to New York City and just shot into the crowds. Neither Ivor Bernstein or anyone else seems to know exactly how many were killed. He says it's around 700, but he also admits that that's just a sort of a wild guess as far as that goes. The first federal military conscription law came online during the Civil War, and so the slavery of military conscription commenced at the same time. All dissenters were smeared as copperheads, and of course copperhead is a rattlesnake, and so you were a snake in the grass. When the Chief Justice of the United States, Roger Bitani, issued an opinion that Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus was unconstitutional, Lincoln issued an arrest warrant for Taney, and he issued arrest warrants for other federal judges as well, and intimidated other federal judges, thereby interfering with the separation of powers. And certainly his deportation of Clement Vallandigham of Dayton, Ohio, intimidated other members of Congress by making them think that if they criticized him, they too could be deported. And so another thing that happened during the war was essentially the death of federalism. There was really the system set up by the American Founding Fathers, and governmental power was totally centralized in Washington, D.C. There was no longer any talk of nullification or secession after the Civil War. Also, there was the creation of the first big lobbying group for an expanded welfare system, and that would be military veterans. Veterans' pensions, by the time you get to 1884, veterans' pensions accounted for about 30% of the entire federal budget. And so that's one of those reasons for the growth of government, apart from war itself, is that the veterans had were a good lobbying group for higher pensions. And they succeeded pretty well at that time, as they do to this day. Also, during the war, during Reconstruction after the Civil War, was a great expansion of taxpayer-financed compulsory government schooling in the South. It had already been started in the northern states, but it was cemented in place in the South also. And another thing that happened was government was viewed as some kind of problem solver. Solve the problem of secession and solve the problem of waging war against millions of people. And the thinking was, well, that can solve just about any kind of problem if it can solve that problem. And so these are some of the legacies of the Civil War in terms of the growth of government. Even if slavery was an issue, even if the war was fought over something totally different, All of this still did happen. Another thing that happened during the Civil War was the average tariff rate before the war, tariff on imports, was about 15%, 1.5, and that was 1857. And that was generally considered to be the high watermark of free trade in the 19th century in America. Very minimal tariffs. By the time the war is over, the average tariff rate is close to 50%. And it stayed in that range between 40 and 50% until 1913, when the federal income tax came into being. And so that certainly permanently ratcheted up protectionism as a trade policy for many, many decades after the Civil War. And so, of course, a lot of this, you know, the military was demilitarized for the most part after the war. A lot of the taxes were done away with. The income tax was done away with in the 1870s. Lincoln did impose the first income tax ever in the United States government, but it was abandoned, and then it was resurrected again in 1913. So some of these powers were given back to the people. Habeas corpus was restored. But all these other things I just mentioned all permanently cemented into place the infrastructure of the highly centralized bureaucratic leviathan that we live under today. That really was the Civil War, in my view, really was the breaking point in American history, where government not only ratcheted up, but became very centralized and monopolistic compared to what it was prior to that war. Now, in World War I, I'll talk about that, I'll skip over the Spanish-American War. But there's a great quote in Bob Higgs' book, Crisis and Leviathan, that summarizes some of the interventions, the ratcheting up of government during World War I. And I'm going to read you that. It's on page 123 of Crisis and Leviathan. And he says this, the American economy remained as late as 1916 predominantly a market system. The next 2 years, however, witnessed an enormous and wholly unprecedented intervention of the federal government in the nation's economic affairs. By the time of the armistice, the government had taken over the ocean shipping, railroad, telephone, and telegraph industries. It had commandeered hundreds of manufacturing plants, just stolen them, entered into massive economic enterprises on its own account, nationalized industries, in such varied departments as shipbuilding, wheat trading, and building construction. It has undertaken to lend huge sums to businesses directly or indirectly and to regulate the private issuance of securities. It established official priorities for the use of transportation facilities, food, fuel, and many raw materials. It also fixed the prices of dozens of important commodities, intervened in hundreds of labor disputes, and conscripted millions of men for service in the armed forces. It had, in short, extensively distorted or wholly displaced markets, creating what some contemporaries call the war socialism, end quote. And it's kind of interesting that the year 1917 was the year of the Russian Revolution that ushered in socialism in Russia and the Soviet Empire. And it's the same year where the United States ushered in American socialism under the guise of war socialism, where the government essentially destroyed the market and took over the economy. And of course, the progressives, the so-called progressives, were all in favor of this because they all thought that this would be a demonstration project for peacetime socialism. And they were all very, very eager to see World War One, to see Americans participate in World War One, but not themselves. They were the original chicken hawks. Okay, so there was other things that happened during World War One was the seizure of thousands of private boats and vessels. There was a law called the Lever Act that created central planning of all food and fuel. Herbert Hoover was put in charge of being the food czar. He was in charge of all the food. And of course, at the same time, the prohibition movement was gaining strength. And 1919 was the amendment that outlawed alcohol. And so Hoover was instrumental in that. The advocates of prohibition wanted Hoover to prohibit the use of all kinds of grains for the making of beer and other types of alcohol, which he did. And so even before alcohol was outlawed, they were trying to drive up the cost or make it impossible to produce alcoholic beverages. There was an Army Appropriations Act called for seizing any transportation mode, your car, for example. And there was a central planning board created called the War Industries Board that converted whole industries to wartime use. And of course, price controls were pervasive, which totally destroyed markets. And there was a takeover of railroads, also the nationalization of railroads. So this was all war socialism that occurred in the United States. And after the war, after World War One, much of this was disbanded, but the military-industrial complex exploded during World War One, and the same 15 or 20 corporations that had profited tremendously as defense contractors during World War One are pretty much the same ones that exist today, and that still benefit primarily from the American defense establishment. So it sort of cemented into place this cabal of the military-industrial congressional complex in World War One, even though they did denationalize all these industries. Although what they did in telephone, for example, the telephone industry was nationalized, and then after World War One was over, the federal government did not deregulate and privatize. It handed over the telephone industry to the states, and the states made AT&T a monopoly in each state. So if you lived in New York, the New York regulatory authorities regulated AT&T in New York. If you lived in Mississippi, the Mississippi regulatory authorities regulated AT&T in New York, but it was a monopoly in long-distance phone service. No matter where you lived, it was regulated by state governments instead of federal government. But it was originally taken over by the federal government during World War One so that they could censor all telephone conversations, in theory, anyway. Another thing that happened in terms of the ratchet effect was what happened with the income tax. The original income tax was put in place in 1913. The first bracket was 1%, and you had to make $20,000 in income to pay 1% income tax. Now, if you multiply $20,000 by 20, you get an idea of how much money that is in today's dollars. the dollar is about worth about 1/20th of what it was in 1913, thanks to the Fed. Okay. Okay, the top bracket in 1913, top bracket was 7%. No one paid more than 7%, and you had to make $500,000 paid 7% in at that point. Okay, so again, multiply 500,000 times 20, and you get an idea of what in today's money that would be. Top bracket, 7% income tax rate. By 1920, the World War I had just ended. The first bracket went up from 1% to 4%, and you didn't have to make $20,000 a year. You only had to make $4,000 a year. The top bracket, by 1920, when World War I was just ending, top bracket had gone up from 7% to 73%. And although you had to make $1 million to be in the 73% tax bracket, and then it eventually went down by 1928, the top rate was still 25%, but that's still more than three times what it was originally. And also the original bracket, the lowest bracket, went down to 1 1/8%. That was still higher than it originally was. So everyone was snared by the income tax thanks to World War I. And of course, by the time you get to World War II, the top bracket was pushed all the way up to 94%. And that stayed along for a very long time, not quite that high. But by the time you get to 1980, the top bracket, top income tax bracket, was still 70%. So I believe you only needed to make family income of about $200,000 in 1980, rather, to be in that top marginal income tax bracket of 70%. And that's when Ronald Reagan came in, of course, and the tax reform dropped the top rate to 28%. And so that certainly ratcheted up income taxation as a result of World War I and ensnared everybody. It also greatly expanded the number of tax collectors in the IRS. World War II was very similar in the ratcheting up of government during World War II. We had massive conscription. For example, there were about, the Great Depression was still on. The unemployment rate in 1940 was still in the 15% range, whereas it had been below 3% in 1929. And so there were about 7.5 million people unemployed in America, but over 11 million went into the military, and most of whom were drafted. And so it's no surprise that unemployment disappeared because 11 million people were sent to the military. The top tax rate was raised to 94%. There was an explosion of government borrowing and money printing by the Fed and the Treasury. The dollar lost half its value. So the price level during World War II basically doubled. The dollar lost half its value. And of course, as with the Lincoln administration and the Wilson administration, during World War I, I didn't mention this yet, but you had the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. They were both aimed at making it illegal to criticize the Wilson administration and his war. And many people went to prison. I mentioned that Eugene Debs was sentenced to 10 years in prison for merely speaking out against the war, and many other people were imprisoned as well. And the government hired spies and hired thousands of spies to spy on their fellow citizens to see if they were making anti-war statements and reporting them to the authorities. In World War II, of course, the most notorious attack on civil liberties was the rounding up of thousands of Japanese Americans and putting them in concentration camps. Franklin Roosevelt himself used the phrase concentration camps to describe these things even before people started describing the Jewish Holocaust in terms of concentration camps there. Before that language was used to refer to the Holocaust, Roosevelt was referring to the Japanese Americans, many of whom were third generation. Not one Japanese American was ever accused of a crime, let alone prosecuted and convicted for a crime. Not even accused, not one. And there were many thousands of them. If you go online and just Google pictures of Japanese internment camps during World War II, you'll see all sorts of pictures of children surrounded by barbed wire for 4 years or longer. And they continued to harass some of these people even after the war was over. Italian and German Americans were also harassed and discriminated against, but nothing like Japanese Americans were. Newspapers, radio, and television were all censored during World War II. There was the nationalization of industries. There was there were pervasive price controls. They were put on, entire industries were seized. The government interfered in labor relations. They didn't want strikes to occur, so they didn't allow unions to go on strike in many cases, and where they were producing things that were used for the military. And tax rates remained high. Capital markets were largely socialized with the creation of something called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. That was created during the Great Depression, but it was also used for war policies also. And of course, there was rationing of consumer goods during World War II. And of course, there was the massive growth of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower would warn about 16 years later after the end of World War II. And so that certainly was a ratcheting up of the powers of the state. And once again, after the war ended, yeah, there was the demilitarization. For example, the U.S. The federal budget went from about $65 billion in 1945 to about $35 billion in 1947. And that created the biggest economic boom in the history of America. The year 1946 was the biggest growth in the private sector of the United States in all of American history in more than 200 years. And the economic historians usually get this all wrong because they count government spending as a part of economic growth, GDP. And of course, there was a big reduction in government spending. But if you look at private consumption and investment spending, it skyrocketed at the same time government was cutting back by two-thirds because of the demobilization of the military. And so government did cut back, but never cuts back all the way. We still kept a lot of the controls on. We still had the military-industrial complex. We still had a much bigger military than we did before the war, to be sure. And so that's, and of course, you could tell similar stories about all the other wars, about the Vietnam War, the Korean War, and certainly the War on Terror, as George W. Bush called it. He spelled T-E-R-R-A. But I guess I don't want to belabor the point, but I guess we could update Robert Higgins' book. And this was published in the 1980s. We've had a few more wars since then, and I guess he could write another chapter to it if he wanted to for the more current wars. And he has written a lot, by the way. He has a few more books on this whole subject of the War on Terror and what it has done to civil liberties and other things. And another book of his that I would recommend, by the way, is The War, Depression, and Cold War. It's a collection of essays by Robert Higgs on different aspects of war, war financing, special interest group influence, and so forth. So The War, Depression, War, and Cold War is the title of that. Okay, and I see it's about, I have about 8:15, so I've gone on about 45 minutes, as I usually do, in my overview of what I wanted to say. And so I'll turn to the second part of the class is I'll welcome anybody who has questions or chats, questions, either the Q&A or anywhere else. Let's see, here's a question from Stanton. If the Federal Reserve is independent within government, how do they go about coordinating with the Defense and Armed Forces divisions and perpetuating war? Well, the Fed is not independent of government. It might say it is, but it's lying to you. Go online, you can find an article of mine entitled The Myth of the Independent Fed. It was published by the Mises Institute. I think it was originally published by Fee. FEE.org, F-E-E.org. And the Fed has never been independent. The chairman of the Fed is appointed by the president, after all. And it does have stockholders, but it's controlled by government. And when the president appoints a chairman of the Fed, he implicitly has to get the permission of the Senate, because the Fed chairman has to go through the appointment process. And if the president appoints somebody who he knows that the Congress will not approve of, he won't appoint that person. That person will be dead in the water. And so that's the way in which Congress implicitly affects who gets appointed to the Fed. It has to be acceptable to a majority, or else the president is wasting his time in appointing that person. And so the Fed does work hand in hand with the government. The Fed has always been the financing arm, and partial financing arm of the government's wars. And so it's just not true. The premise of the question is not true. The Fed is independent. It really is a laugh. I think the Fed is independent of the government. If I read my article, The Myth of the Independent Fed, they don't always make it explicit in how they're collaborating with the executive branch, but they do talk a lot. The president will make speeches, his people will make speeches, his appointees will make speeches in public to let the Fed know what they want them to do. And if you study monetary economics, one of the things you learn about is so-called accommodating monetary policy. It accommodates what the executive branch does with spending and taxing. And that's economists have been talking about that for many, many decades. But at the same time, the same economists in their same textbooks will say the Fed is independent. So it's sort of schizophrenic in how they talk about these things. Greg Ward is asking, a recent executive order signed by Obama pretty much sealed us in as a fascist nation. I've read it. It was on LouRockwell.com a couple of days ago. That said that I, King Obama, give myself the authority in case of war or crisis, defined by me, King Obama, to commandeer all resources related to land, agriculture, water, electricity, and on and on and on. And I don't know if I'd call that fascism or communism. It's hard to tell. But Obama doesn't really fancy himself a fascist. He's been a communist his whole life. He said in one of his numerous autobiographies that when he was in college, he always sought out all the Marxist professors. And that seems to be in the crowd he associated with in Chicago were all the real extreme radical communists like William Ayers and Reverend Wright and Acorn, the group Acorn. These are all radical, far-left Marxist ideologues, and that's who Obama is. So I would call him a communist, not a fascist. And those are my thoughts. He hasn't done it. He signed an executive order. And of course, there's nothing whatsoever in the Constitution that would allow any president to get himself the authority to take over the water supply and agriculture and all these things. But the whole idea of executive order is just dictatorship. And so, but our presidents, not just Obama, they do tend to think of themselves as dictators, don't they? Let's see what's going on in the chat here. Let's see, Graham. If Lincoln was able to fool all the people all the time, oh no, there was tremendous dissent in the northern states. That's why he had to bring the army in to murder New Yorkers when they rioted over the draft. That's why he had military conscription on the draft. That's why he employed as many as 200,000 or so European mercenaries to fight his war. There was a lot of opposition. The Republican Party denigrated the opponents of the war as copperheads or snakes in the grass. And so, no, he certainly didn't fool them. The civil libertarians were not fooled when he suspended habeas corpus and mass arrested thousands of civilians for simply speaking up against the war and against his other policies. Let's see, Graham is also asking, did he do it because of a group or class of men backing him to fund their schemes and projects, government money taxed primarily from the South? Well, Lincoln spent his entire life in politics as a Whig before he became a Republican just a few years into the 1850s. And the Whigs, their economic program was protectionist tariffs, corporate welfare, and central banking to pay for it all. And of course, the first thing he did was lavish subsidies on the railroad corporations, and he was a railroad corporation lawyer his whole career in Illinois. And so, yes, that's who funded the Republican Party. Whether or not the South paid most of the tariff tax or not, it certainly paid a big chunk of it. So when 11 states left the Union, that was a big chunk of federal tax revenue that was leaving. Whether it was 20% or 80% or whatever the percentage was, it was big, sizable. And Lincoln, if you read Abe Lincoln's first inaugural address, he literally threatened invasion and bloodshed. Those are his exact words. Over any state that failed to collect the tariff tax, which had just been doubled 2 days earlier signed into law by President Buchanan at the very end of his presidency. I don't really know anything about Obama's dual role as president and chairman of the UN Security Council. Philip is asking me that. That's really not my bag. Let's see. Connor is asking, in the essay, War is the Health of the State, Randolph Bourne says state and government are two different things. And he says the government is just sort of a bureaucratic apparatus. It carries out the day-to-day functions of the state. Would be like the Hillary Clintons and Barack Obamas and George W. Bushes of the world, the movers and shakers. And the government is the bureaucrats who take orders from them, including the military bureaucrats who carry out their orders. I think that's what the distinction he's trying to make there. I'll go back to Q&A here. And by the way, Robert Higgs, for a long, long time, he's called us our system in America participatory fascism. We're allowed to vote, yes, and we're allowed to participate in politics, but it's basically fascism as an economic system. And fascism, by the way, from an economic perspective, allowed private property to exist, but it was very heavily controlled by the state, and it was directed in a way that it would serve the purposes as defined by the state. That's what economic fascism is. And that's basically the system we have. In fact, one of Robert Higgs's students, 25 years ago or so, wrote a book called The Coming American Fascism. I forget her name at the moment, but if you Google The Coming American Fascism, you'll find Charlotte Twight. That's who it is, Charlotte Twight, T-W-I-G-H-T. She was a graduate student of Robert Higgs at the University of Washington way back when in the 1980s. And she wrote this book, I think while she was in graduate school, she wrote this book. And it makes the case that even back then, we had already become essentially a fascist state in terms of our economic policies. And when you think about it, the New Deal was, they called it managed capitalism. But the actual policies were very, very similar to what the Nazis had done and what the Italians had done under Mussolini. And there were a lot of American industrialists and politicians who admired Mussolini and Hitler greatly, before they became adversaries in war. And Winston Churchill was a big fan of Mussolini. He once said that had he been Italian, he would have donned a fascist black shirt had he been Italian. Of course, that was before Mussolini teamed up with Hitler in the war against England. Fascism is our system, basically, that we have, although we're moving closer to socialism with the de facto nationalization of some automobile companies and in the banking industry under Obama. Let's see if there's anything else in the chat here. Chatters. Danny mentioned in England, Bertrand Russell was in prison for speaking out against the war. That's true. I remember reading about that somewhere along the line. I'm just looking for other questions here. Okay, Greg wants to know, where do I think Rumsfeld's missing trillions went? Well, they didn't go to the Mises Institute. They didn't go to me. Who knows? Who knows where that went? I guess you're talking about trillions. I'd like to know where those pallets full of $100 bills went. It was sent to Iraq. Isn't that the ultimate goofy Keynesian economics? Sending pallets of money to supposedly stimulate the Iraq economy. And of course, we did, and it's still a disaster. Gravity's Rainbow. What is that, Greg? Is that a book? I'm not familiar with Gravity's Rainbow. Well, it looks like we're running out of gas here early tonight, which is okay. You're here to hear a lecture and learn something, I hope. Let's see. Connor's asking me, I guess, how's my new book doing? I just finished chapter 26 today in my new book. The title is going to be Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. And it'll probably be about 50 chapters or so. And they're not real long chapters, but it covers, in fact, I have part of the agenda for it here, the different sections are going to be one is called Politics and Thieves. Another section is called Coercion and Regulation, Centralization versus Liberty, Workers and Unions, Trade and Freedom, Money in the State, and the Truth about the Free Market. Those are all sections, and each section will have 5 to 7 or 8 chapters in each section on those different topics. And it's not going to be 1,000 pages, I don't think. I mean, Lou Rockwell said on Mises.org, 400 pages, but that's sort of what we have in mind. So people don't read 1,000-page books. Very few people do anyway. So that should be finished in a couple of weeks, and then it'll go through the editing process and so forth. And I hope it'll be out by the end of the summer. It'll certainly be out by the Mises Institute's 30th anniversary conference at Callaway Gardens, Georgia, in October. Okay, well, maybe we'll call it a night then. I see no more questions here other than, is my book done yet? Well, the government would love to stifle the Mises Institute, I'm sure, but it's not doing a very good job of it. After all, we're here tonight doing this, and we're carrying on. But I guess we've run out of gas, and thank you all for attending, and those of you who didn't attend, I hope you get something out of this, and also, and I'll see you again next week, and have a good night.